Okay. Hi, Jinx.
One of your favorite topics, so I'll let you go.
Oh, yeah.
Take care.
Andy Serling, everybody. The action returns Thursday to the Big A. And I think there's a good chance, I hope. We got both Scherzando and Kid Chocolate. There's races in the book for both of them on Saturday again. So hopefully they both go, and we'll go down to Aqueduct on Saturday. That'd be fun. All right, 90 minutes in, 90 to come. And as I mentioned, Alan Foreman is going to join us, and Chuck and Sid. So we will begin to, we will feather them in here. And I think Chuck is in the studio.
I am.
Chuck?
I am oh. here.
You got, there's
back.
Back in the studio. I love it. What hat? What hat are you wearing?
Unfinished business.
Unfinished business.
I have no idea what it means, but it was $10 at the hat store. So
you got it on the clearance rack. So wait a minute.
It's
so
kind
the
of a
dolphins?
Cool thing. No, it's not a dolphin. Dolphins have lots of unfinished business.
I was going to say
the last 30 years have been unfinished business. Yes. Actually, though, we could say they're finished. there'll be some dolphin-filled tuna showing up on the shelves soon. The carcasses of the current season.
Well, you can't complain. You should not complain, because you came from off the mat to make it. They made a run. They made it interesting.
Well. They had a nice run. It was a nice 7 weeks, but the rest of the season has kind of been a disaster. But, I mean, that's not like it's not out of character for them. I mean, we're still kind of hanging our hats on the undefeated season, which I was too young to actually appreciate. So, you know, when your biggest highlights are, you know, Dan Marino and a team from 1973... It's not. It's been rough, man. It's been rough.
I don't know if I've ever given you my my proximity. The only proximity I can offer to that Dolphin team. Nick Buonaconte was a member of our country club in Connecticut. Even though he lived in Springfield, Mass, he would come to Ellington, Connecticut, and so we would see Nick all the time.
A legend inside the NFL on HBO. It's like the first kind of not a studio show, but kind of a studio show.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, like that's true.
A recap show before they had 57 of them.
Yeah, exactly. I'm going to send you a. I know this is going to sound crazy, but a very funny obituary that was written by a son to his mother, and one of the principal early humorous lines in it is referencing what a Dolphin fan she was and mentioning that she was predeceased by Don Shula.
Well, it's kind of a great lead-in to our discussion about Heisa and USADA with the obituaries and the Dolphins tanking season again. The Dolphins are just like racing, right? Every year there's kind of some hope, and then they kind of give you a flash, and then all of a sudden you get disappointed. And there never really seems to be a plan.
Well, Alan Foreman is going to join us here, I think, and then Sid Fernando as well, and we'll bat this around because, of course, right before Christmas weekend, the word came that Heisa and USADA were going to fail to reach an agreement to make USADA. Fulfilling a role as the contracted party involved in the monitoring of the testing and the application of that side of what Heisa is bringing potentially to the industry. We've had Alan regularly, and most recently when Alan was with us, it was during symposium and then right after. And Alan, good morning. Happy New Year.
You too, Steve. Good morning. Happy New Year to all your listeners.
Chuck Simon with us as well. How acquainted are you, Chuck, are you with Alan? You know Alan?
I don't believe we've ever met.
No. We have had a very common close friend in Rick Violette, and I used to hear about Chuck and Chuck's views from Rick. But I don't think we've ever, you know, really gotten together.
Well, we'll await Sid joining in as well. But Alan, I suppose the easiest way to get started here is for you to follow up where we left things after Arizona, and anybody that listened to you and Sid and Eric Hamelbeck and Jay Privman during that week, they might have been ready for this news. I mean, it seemed to be a bombshell to people, but you had made it very clear that there was uncertainty regarding USATA. The other part of the uncertainty and the hubbub that this produced revolved around people's perception that USATA was going to be the dog and HISA was the tail, when in fact it was reversed. HISA was always, under the statute, going to be in charge of everything.
Right. So Charlie Sheeler, who is the chairman of the new HISA Authority Board, gave a presentation in Tucson, and I think he telegraphed during his remarks that there had not been an agreement reached with USATA, that they were continuing to negotiate, and I think part of the tip-off was that he announced a delay in what would be the implementation of post-race testing to January 1, 2023. I mean, one of the problems with this whole HISA legislation and enactment is it has created an unrealistic frame to shift the industry into this new paradigm. It's just too aggressive. And while we saw that the safety program regulations, which had been previewed by the industry, had been changed in numerous parts as a result of comments coming from industry organizations and regulators, that was rolled out, and that should be announced any day now by the FTC for publication and then the formal comment period. That was not happening with the anti-doping and medication control program. So we knew there were issues, we knew there were tensions between the industry, scientific community, and USADA, but the statute mandated that the parties act in good faith and seek to enter into a commercially reasonable contract, which, from the announcement, it appears they were not able to do. Who walked away from whom, I don't know, and I don't know that it really matters. They could not come to an agreement. And the statute provides that if they cannot come to an agreement, then HISA can look to another organization of national prominence that can assist it in what HISA wants it to do. One of the problems we have is nobody really knows what it is that HISA is looking for the enforcement agency partner to do, the contract party. And if we knew what it was that HISA wants them to do, it probably would make this analysis a lot easier. But as you know, USADA rolled out a series of what it called its proposed regulations, not on the HISA website and not, to the best of my knowledge, with the approval of the HISA board, but on their own, and started engaging in a public relations campaign to push their program as the program for horse racing.
Let me welcome Sid in too. Sid Fernando joins us. Sid, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Steve. Glad to be here. Thanks.
Well, you've got Alan, you've got Chuck Simon, and Alan, with that introduction, I suppose you're right. The whys and wherefores about there's been any number of suggestions made that USADA really didn't really want to do this when it came right down to it. Then there was conversation about some of the details of the testing elements. There were suggestions that, as well, that the cost, you know, the you know, what the compensation was going to be involved. It doesn't particularly matter at this point. The portion of this that everybody, as stakeholders and horse players and fans, want to know is where does it lead from here, and what the mechanics will be. And before I ask Chuck and Sid for some feedback, suggest, Alan, what you think a path forward looks like from here.
Well, I think that the HISA board has to define precisely what it is looking for in terms of an enforcement program, because the statute mandates that HISA have an enforcement program run by what's intended to be a third-party contractor. That is somebody working on HISA's behalf under the authority of HISA and with direction from HISA. And that falls into different areas. One would be, you would think, the disciplinary portion of the program, and what would hopefully be uniform discipline in a fair due process program for horsemen, but one that gives confidence to not only those in the industry, but those outside the industry, that violations, depending upon their seriousness, are being dealt with in an appropriate fashion and in a timely fashion. Because that was one of the underpinnings of why there was support for HISA. Number two, oversight of a drug testing accreditation program and an improvement in our laboratories and in our drug testing and more uniform drug testing. That is something you would look for a third party to do. We're currently doing that through the RMTC, which through its accreditation program does a terrific job. And it's a challenging job, regardless of what industry is looking for an outside accrediting agency. And increased out-of-competition testing and overseeing a better out-of-competition testing program. And finally, and I think the most important thing, and I think this is what really has people concerned, is the creation of an investigative arm of the industry that we once had and we lost and we don't have. Because I think that having an effective investigative force for the industry in uncovering wrongdoing that may be occurring in our industry is something that we all strive for, and it's finding somebody to do that. I think it's important to understand that USADA doesn't have, and they would tell you, they don't have the skill set in those areas. They would essentially be engaging with other parties to do that work for them. They would essentially be overseeing the program. So, for example, if you were looking for an investigative arm of the industry, USADA doesn't provide that. USADA would go out and either they would develop the program or hire a third party to conduct that program. I personally would like to see the TRPB recreated if we can do that. I think it would be very effective. And maybe working with private investigative agencies that are well known around the country and indeed around the world. So what HISA has to do is define exactly what it's looking for and then identify organizations or groups that specialize in this area. They don't have to be equine related, because there aren't a lot that are equine related but still have the skill set that they can work with us to provide exactly what the statute calls for. USADA clearly was a standout, but it wasn't and isn't the only game in town, and I think that the statute contemplated that it might not be the only game in town, especially if there could not be an agreement reached between the HISA board and USADA, which is where we are right now.
Alan Foreman, everybody, and Chuck, I'll turn to you with that note. Where do you perceive things to be, and from a horseman's perspective and horse player, where did this set of circumstances, where does Where does it leave you? And what do you think needs to happen to satisfy all the areas of concern?
That's a tough question, Steve. I'm not. After listening to Alan's kind of dissertation of a lot of the things that we had assumed were happening, and that you kind of confirmed them, it was just kind of haphazardly thrown together, and I'm sure that it wasn't, but it seems that way. And to me, they just, number one, focus too much on bringing professional people, esteemed names, very highly credentialed people in, yet they had virtually no practical experience. And that was one of the things I always thought was a problem. I watched football my whole life. I've never really played. I played 1 year in high school. We played, the equivalent of the Bad News Bears of high school football. But I've never been taught. I've never coached. I've never really looked at it on a high level. And if you brought me in and you said, I want to revamp the rules of the NFL, well, I wouldn't bring in people from the U.S. Tennis Association and people from the Joint Chiefs. I would bring in referees, and I would bring in coaches and players and get the, not a consensus, but get their input. And that is one thing that it seems like from the beginning, and I'm not talking like just since this thing was passed. I'm talking about a decade ago when all this kind of started to bubble to the surface, that everyone has kind of looked down their nose at the industry people and kind of said, hey, like, they can't be trusted. And yeah, sure, there are people that certainly can't, but they wouldn't be the kind of people that we would have. And Alan mentioned Rick Violette earlier in the year. And I mean, Rick was a friend, and Rick was really a great liaison for the Horsemen and these kind of organizations. It's sad. I mean, we miss them every day. But it just seems like there's been no industry input in here. And that, to me, was always going to be a fatal issue. You're always going to create issues when you make rules without people with practical experience explaining why they maybe need to be tweaked, or why they won't work, or why they would work better in a certain way. I don't have any dealings with USADA other than I know some people in the cycling world, and they're obviously weren't real big fans of them. And it wasn't really the mission. It was more the tactics. And I also have some contacts in the boxing world, and they wouldn't use them. And that kind of says a lot to me. I guess that's water under the bridge now, but they don't have, and this was the one thing that I tried to tell people, like, you guys have these huge expectations for HISA. You think it's going to do everything. You think they're going to fix race riding issues. You think they're going to fix horse rescue. You think they're going to come in and just rule as a czar. And I go, it just isn't that way. I mean, you'd think that they would handle the issues of integrity on the wagering side, right? I mean, that would be something with the billions of dollars bet across state lines that it would be something that they would be interested in, and they apparently weren't. But to me, it's always been kind of like, let's just get this thing passed and then we'll figure it out. And that always seemed like it was going to be a problem, because you're talking about a huge industry, and this industry has shrunk, but we're still all across the country. And the difference between us and other sports is that even the bad teams in the NFL, even the bad teams in the NBA, even the bad teams in Major League Baseball are still professional teams owned by billionaires, well-funded. They're all more or less on the same plane. Where in horse racing, the difference between the smaller tracks and the Keenelands and the Saratogas is massive, and as well, there's a difference in funding ability. There's a difference in the amount of attention, the amount of money that's bet. It's just
it's a very difficult thing to try to boil down to, okay, we're going to have one rule and this is going to work across the entire spectrum. And that's not even talking about what has really bugged me the most about the thing was no one has ever really said, A, how much it's going to cost, and B, how it's going to be paid for. And, I mean, all the other stuff we talk about really doesn't mean anything unless this can be funded properly. And it can be funded properly without, sinking two-thirds of the industry. Because these people who think that you can horse racing, thoroughbred horse racing is going to survive with seven or eight tracks are nuts. It's not. It's going to sink. It's going to go under. There's way, way, way too much competition for the gambling dollar, and the breeding industry would be severely injured. The sales industry would be severely injured, and there's a lot of people that are invested in this business because of that. I mean, listen, they're the tail wagging a dog in a lot of ways. We get it, but by the same token, you take a lot of that money, that investment money out. And then where are we at?
There's a couple of things there, and I've got something for Alan out of that that I'll come back to. But what you just said brings me to Sid. And Sid, not worrying about the legalities of HISA right this minute, you certainly have been in enough contact with breeding farms in your business role. One of the things that I have found curious is the at least outward presentation by the breeding side that they were supporting this whole hog when it had the potential to do exactly what Chuck is suggesting, which is reduce the viability of bloodstock as a business. And I have found that completely strange the last several years that there was this alleged support by the breeders for this direction when in fact it had that potential to make the industry smaller. Is that inaccurate, or what's your pulse taking on this in your conversation on the breeding community?
Well, you know, what Alan said and what Chuck just talked about, and now what you're asking me, all comes down to funding. And the way this bill is written, Steve, is it's supposed to be funded by industry participants. In fact, breeders are mentioned, trainers, owners. Everyone's supposed to fund this thing, right? But this organization, HISA, came about with no official funding behind it. Right now, as they're operating, it's apparently from loans. They're supposed to take loans to create the bureaucracy. And then, as Chuck pointed out, the mystery funding, they're supposed to then create everything Alan just talked about in terms of, let's just stick to the anti-doping, the USADA segment of it, not the racing safety part, but just the USADA segment. It's supposed to be funded going forward. Now, they're operating right now on presumably on loans or whoever has given money to create these guys, the board, as they're doing this. Obviously, they're getting paid. So that's part on loans. Now it's supposed to get into the funding part. And it's kind of set up similarly to like a self-regulatory authority organization, SROs, like the financial industry's regulatory authority, which is FINRA, for example. You hear them always trot out FINRA as an example. Now, FINRA was funded right away. Again, it was set up the same way. It's supposed to, it was congressional authority set up FINRA under the auspices of the SEC. But FINRA was funded, heavily funded by the sale of NASDAQ, and they had a huge nest egg to begin with. Even if you look at USADA, for example, which operates, again, as a nonprofit on its own, that's actually federally funded. In 2020, the Senate authorized over the next decade $175 million funding boost for USADA. This thing is starting out with no funding even to get started. And now they're supposed to be doing exactly what, you know, Alan pointed out on this anti-doping segment of it. Well, they've put down in the rules now that it's supposed to be funded, as you pointed out, breeders, owners, covered persons, right? Or the state in which those covered persons operate can come up with they can come up with some formula based on starts and fund that. Now, what's really important here in this version of the bill, you know, all these HISA came about, as you know, through all these horse racing integrity acts which failed 2015, 2017. Then Mitch McConnell came on board in September of 2020 and introduced this into the Senate and a compromise. They somehow got this to tack it onto that bill, the omnibus bill on December 27th that Trump signed, 2.3 million bill. But they tacked this thing on without fleshing it out. So what we're at right now, the situation where USADA has these talks with the HISA is because it's no secret. It's because of funding. USADA needs money to do all this stuff. Just for an example, and by the way, one last before I get into this example, keep in mind HISA is only applicable to the thoroughbred industry. It's not the quarter horses and the U.S. the trotters. You know, it's only the thoroughbreds, right? The bill before this was going to incorporate all of that, but it just went to only thoroughbreds. So think about this. You have the state regulatory commissions that oversee thoroughbreds and standardbreds, right?
And quarter horse.
This thing is only for the thoroughbreds. So what is the state supposed to do?
Yep.
Fund something for the thoroughbreds while they continue to oversee the standardbreds? I mean, it's a bureaucratic nightmare the more you look into this. And part of the funding of this is either taxing individual participants like breeders, owners, yada, 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 or having the state fund that segment voluntarily, quote unquote, based on some kind of formula which hasn't even been announced, but apparently is based on some per starts per basis. But think about this. Say you have a regulatory body, a state regulatory body in a state, and say, to keep numbers simple, say that they pay $1,000, you know, just to keep it round numbers, $1,000 it costs to oversee, you know, the funding of regulatory issues in racing. Say it costs $1,000, and say $700 of that goes towards thoroughbreds and $300 goes towards standardbreds, okay? Now with this thing and everything these guys want to do, that $700 thoroughbred part is going to double at least in cost because of everything they want to do. So now a state is looking at paying, you know, say $1,400 for thoroughbreds and the $300 for standardbreds. They're looking at a cost increase any way you look at it, everything they want to do, out of testing, a lab, state-of-the-art lab, state-of-the-art investigations. As Alan pointed out, USADA would have to farm that out to somebody else and no doubt get together with this five stones and come up with another layer of expense that's involved. Look, all of this stuff is going to create so much more capital outlay, and this looks like a back of napkin math computation when you need serious financial people and planners to plan something. It's extremely amateurish. And it's like a house built on matchsticks. That's why it's falling down right now. USADA is used to having a lot of money to play with. And there's absolutely one reason why it failed, and that's money. And it's not coming from anywhere right now. And there's no plan in place to get that money, because if the state does not pay voluntarily, USADA then, the anti-doping part, has to then go out and tax individual people, individual breeders, trainers, owners, jockeys, valets, whatever. That's a bureaucratic nightmare. So there's so many details to this that spell doom, really. Even if they get another body to step in for USADA, the problems exist in the planning and what's written in that bill. I read that bill again last night, and it's shocking, really.
Well,
this thing actually went through.
Well, it went through. I'm going to turn to you, because obviously there's a handful of things that just came up on, from both Chuck and Sid, that I'd love for you to help people, you know, understand and interpret. But I got to ask, I mean, considering everybody keeps asking where the money would come from, how is it that nobody has stood up and said, let's see, the Jockey Club is the one who steered the ship into the iceberg. They're the ones who for 10 years have poisoned the well to make the public think that this is a filthy game with a bunch of inept horsemen that are drug addled. It's that completely responsible, the Jockey Club is, for that attitude pervading. They're the ones who have equated therapeutic medication overages with doping, and they're the ones who have been holding data hostage for decades. Why has nobody stood up and said, why doesn't the Jockey Club write the check and pay for this? If it's such a priority in their eagerness to rid the game of Lasix that they've left us in this, painted into this corner, why don't they start writing some checks?
It's a lot of money.
Not the law. It's not the statute. That's fine.
Well, that was convenient then. That was convenient of the way they wrote the statute that they didn't put themselves on the hook.
Well, in the statute right now, and the formation of this HISA, HISA is getting loans and money from people. Obviously, the Jockey Club is giving them a loan, or, you know, where are they getting that money from? Well, obviously, a group of rich guys out there are funding it right now as it stands, so they can get going and generate their own money. It's like FINRA, though, Steve. FINRA, it taxes individuals and corporations, so like all brokers, whatnot. They get money from those fees that feed its bureaucracy and keep it going. This is what these guys are trying to do, but they've got, you know, they can't tax everybody, and they don't have the infrastructure to take care of it right now.
Well, Alan, jump into that and then, you know, address those areas that came up and your thoughts.
Well, I do want to talk history, because history is critical here to understanding how we got to where we are. But on the issue of funding, it's easy to criticize what the bill provides, but in the absence of context, in the absence of knowing precisely how they intend to go about doing this, where the costs are going to be, and by the way, this whole program fails if they don't enter into partnerships with regulators. So what a lot of people don't understand is this can't possibly succeed without agreements with the various racing commissions across the country. And one of the criticisms that I heard with respect to the whole several months of USADA was that nobody was talking to the regulators. And if a regulatory body racing commission decided it wasn't going to play ball in this arena, then all the responsibilities that are currently provided by that racing commission would be assumed by HISA, and HISA is not equipped to take over those responsibilities. So we know that one of the things that has to happen going forward is relationships with state racing commissions, which I think helps going forward to define how this could start to play out. But I've got to jump in here on history, because Sid is right. For years, I think 6 to 8 years, there were, through three or four Congresses, various versions of what was called the Horse Racing Integrity Act. I testified against one of those versions. Really, those versions were a pretext to eliminate LASIK. So it wasn't really about uniformity. They floated the idea of uniformity, but it really wasn't about that. It was about eliminating LASIK and putting USADA in charge of the oversight of anti-doping and medication control in this industry. In fact, the board that would have governed, had one of those bills passed, would have been Travis Tigert as chair, five other members of the USADA board, and five members of the industry appointed by USADA. So for various reasons, those bills never got out of committee, and I think there were only one hearing. There was a second hearing before the current version. But here's what changed. 30-plus horses died at Santa Anita, and that changed the whole dynamic for the industry, because you had legislators in California who wanted to shut down horse racing. You had national media calling for an end to horse racing. You had the Washington Post calling for an end to horse racing. I mean, we were the next Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus, okay? That changed everything, and the industry leadership determined that it needed to do something to stem the losses here, okay? Or is everybody there? Okay. So the industry leadership convened in New York, August 2 years ago, and set on a path asking the NTRA to try to come up with consensus concepts and legislation that might address the problems that we face. That is, horses dying on the racetrack. It wasn't about doping. It's about horses dying on the racetrack. And so we hired a law firm, Akin Gump, in Washington, D.C., internationally known law firm, to help us structure how we could create an authority that would bring uniformity in adoption of rules, uniformity in discipline, better uniform testing, and address those needs that the industry has to address our problems of horses dying on the racetrack, including the adoption of a safety program very similar to what we do in the Mid-Atlantic with the Mid-Atlantic Strategic Plan, but mandate rather than making that a voluntary program. Everything we do in this industry, because we're a state-sanctioned, state-regulated business, is voluntary. There's no hammer, and we've been looking for that hammer for years. How do you get everybody to adopt and follow the same rules? How do we ensure that horsemen are treated the same no matter where they go? How do we ensure that the testing of our samples is being done evenly and fairly from jurisdiction to jurisdiction? And what are we going to do to ensure that all the tracks are adopting safety programs to try to at least identify horses at risk and reduce the amount of breakdowns? And so using the FINRA model, which was recommended by Akin Gump, this legislation was developed. It was developed over months, almost a year, year and a half. And we met with Travis Tigert, and Tigert said to us, we don't know anything about horse racing, but we have a certain skill set we think we can bring and help you if you're interested. And we said, well, that sounds good. If we maybe hire you as a third party, maybe that's the best way to skin the cat. That's why the legislation reads that way. So in the face of what was a national crisis at the time, we came up with this concept, and Mitch McConnell ran with it. It was a perfect storm. We were, you know, it started with the Service Navarro fiasco. We had had other issues that had caught the attention of national media, and it was a perfect storm of things, and McConnell made very clear, I'm going to push this through. And in the House, the animal welfare organizations had convinced leadership in the House, including Nancy Pelosi from California, and Barbara Feinstein to move this legislation through, or there would be no horse race. So that's the context. Now, last point. We thought the starting point was going to be the RCI model rules. They're clear, they're concise, everybody understands them. For the most part, they're adopted in every jurisdiction. I've never heard anybody complain about the rules themselves. It's that all the states don't adopt them or don't adopt new rules when we have new rules. That doesn't cost money to do, and that should be the starting point, not the new rules that USADA rolled out that were just totally bewildering to everyone and would have completely changed the way we do business, let alone trying to educate our stakeholders into how to follow them. That was the initial, quite frankly, the initial blow up with USADA was their proposed rules. We can implement uniform disciplinary measures. We've got recommended penalty guidelines. We can strengthen them. We've got a multiple medication violation system. The statute mandates that. We can strengthen that system. We've got an accreditation program. We can strengthen that program. We do need an investigative arm. We should pay for that. And we do have a safety program through the NTRA Safety and Integrity Alliance, the Mid-Atlantic Strategic Plan, the Thoroughbred Safety Coalition. We need to mandate that across the board. And that takes into consideration the larger tracks and the smaller tracks, because they all have to be a part of this and we have to accommodate it. I agree that one of the biggest flaws here is that it doesn't cover the standard bred and the quarter horse industry. It has an opt-in provision, and at least in the formative stages, the HISA board thought that they were going to delay what to do with standard bred and quarter horse industries, but that does, Sid is absolutely correct, it does create a dilemma for jurisdictions like New York, Maryland, New Jersey, Pennsylvania that have a single racing commission that regulate both industries. You can't have two sets of rules, personnel doing two different things. It's a nightmare, and they're going to have to figure that out. And then with respect to funding, if you take what's not broken in our industry and try to fix what's broken and take advantage of the efficiencies that you have in the business, you can get to a funding formula that isn't terribly different than what we're doing right now, albeit there might be some for start fees. There might be more funding that will be contributed by the racetracks and other stakeholders in the industry if HISA does it intelligently. That's the way it's designed, to spread it evenly across the board. Now, whether that'll happen or not, I don't know, and I'm in a theoretical world right now. But listen, we had to do something. The status quo simply wasn't going to fly. And whether this is the right way to go, wrong way to go, or otherwise, I guess time will tell. But doing nothing was not an option.
Chuck, we're going to go back to Chuck for a second. And understanding that, you know, as Alan said, and said this, as so did Eric Hamelbeck, that you know, the opportunity was going to be to go to the regulators and craft a workable and you know highly acute and improved you know monitoring, testing, out of competition testing, sample freezing, perhaps something Jerry Brown has talked about for years, all the different elements, and of course boots on the ground, and we've discussed, Alan, with you and in different occasions, you know, the potential for a reinvented TRPB. For you, Chuck, as a horseman, you were very critical of what the USADA portion was offering in terms of, frankly, wasting resources against, you know, small outfits that are the least of our worry when it comes to, you know, potential people taking an edge and you know actively trying to cheat. What should enforcement look like from your perspective?
Well, the problem with USADA is that they're not really built to handle the regulatory position for the scope of the size of horse racing in this country. I mean, how many top-level Olympic athletes do they monitor? A few hundred? And they're people. And
you know, to get back to what Alan said about the status quo, I don't think anybody is really happy with how the regulatory process works in this country. I mean, I think that's a false accusation that's made awful a lot. My problem hasn't been having a national authority of some sort. It makes sense. It's a good idea. But it's always the devil in the details, in that when you set up a national, a federal bill is passed and you set up a national commission, if you don't do it right, then you're going to kill everything. You're going to kill the host. It has to be done right. And USADA was coming in, and they were trying we were going to waste a ton of money monitoring where horses go. When, if you have an investigative force and you think that there are people that are doing things that aren't kosher, then catch them. Don't warn them. But it was going to create an administrative nightmare. If you're talking, how many, 30,000? How many active horses do we have right now in horse racing? You know, we ran, what, 36,000 races last year? So, I mean, how many are there? To think that we're going to have the ability to know where every single one of them is 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, especially when 99% of them are standing in their stalls, the same place that they've been, you know, for the last year or so. It just was kind of, you know, that's a human thing, right? You don't need to know. We know where the horses are, 99% of them, 99% of the time. That's not the issue. Humans can go out of their house and they can meet a guy in a dark alley, right? A shady steroid dealer. Like, horses don't do that. They don't say, you know, I'm not feeling good. Let me go, you know, to the local gym and get a boost in the back, in the parking lot in the back. It just seemed like it was a misunderstanding of really what's going on. If there's people that you believe, and I believe this does happen, people take horses off the track and do something that they can't do on the track to them, well, then catch them. And when you catch them, throw the book at them. My thing is this, is that we have no idea how much this is going to cost. Maybe Alan has a ballpark figure, and I would understand completely that he wouldn't want to have his name attached to it because, you know, no one else has been able to come up with a number. But, I mean, we're just guessing at the number. I don't even know what most of these states spend on a per test basis, on a yearly basis. And I guess, like, it's a little bit complicated for the states that have more than just thoroughbreds, in that they're usually, you know, the budgets are blended in somehow. But a national program is fine, but it just has to be done properly. And, you know, one of the issues that I've always said is that testing should never be the focus. The focus should be investigation, because these are not, you know, James Bond supervillains we're dealing with. If the if the Navarro tapes didn't, and the conversations that came out of that didn't make you aware of that, then, you know, you should know now. So we're not talking also about, you know, like, we don't need to spend the same focus on some guy that's got 27 starts on the year as we do as a guy that's winning 34%. I mean, we know who the suspect characters are, and that's just part of the thing. You know, that's just part of the game. I just have a hard time understanding how this is all going to be funded, and at a time when this business needs an injection of owners, an injection of, and pardon the pun with the injection, but you know, an injection of investment on the horse side, raising costs, it has to show some tangible results. And I mean, we're so far, it seems like, we're so far away from this being a workable plan. I mean, without USADA involved, and like, when you read the bill, there's so much that there is involved, and I don't know if there's any negotiations with any other things. But my thing was that, you know, USADA was always going to create a new division. Why can't the industry hire away a administrator from WADA or VADA, kickstart the TRPB again. We have all the elements.
Exactly.
Why do we need create our own third party? I don't know if it legally would work, but that always seemed to make more sense. But there was always this kind of disrespectful tone that, oh, we can't be we can't trust each other because the industry is showing it can't police itself. Since when are the state regulatory agencies, horse racing people? I mean, seriously. If we could choose to have a regulatory body, would we choose the way these states operate?
Alan, you obviously have got the most experience on that front. Why, if in fact HISA is going to have to craft the contracted portion of this in a different direction with a different currently undefined party, what makes us believe that the regulatory system as it exists can be improved and be what everybody would hope it is?
Well, it depends what it is you want improved. It's all about, your business plan, identifying your goals, and then, attacking each of those potential goals in the best way that you can. As a practical matter, state regulatory bodies have the personnel that are going to be necessary to effectuate whatever we do. If let's take New York, let's suppose the New York Gaming Commission decided it did not want to enter into an agreement with HISA in which the New York Gaming Commission would provide the support services needed to carry out HISA. Then HISA has to do it themselves. They've got to go out and hire an equine medical director. They've got to go out and hire individuals who are going to collect the samples, identify horses, do all the kinds of things that the states are currently doing. Okay,
Alan, could I interrupt one second? Yeah, I believe that most people believe that that's what they are going to do, and that has been a misconception.
Under the statute. That's the point,
right? That's been a misconception from day one with this. Everyone that I talk to, not everyone, but a great deal of the horsemen and the bettors as well, that they think that HISA is going to be this huge operation that's going to take over all the drug testing, and they're going to have a secret lab somewhere in the Midwest, and everything's going to be sent out there, and they're going to have the FBI knocking on people's doors. And I just think there's I think they've done a poor job of really detailing what it is that they are and what they're going to do or try to do, because there's a real misconception out there that they are just not only taking over the testing and taking over the investigative wing, but they are going to be it.
You're absolutely right. I couldn't agree more. The misinformation, the continuing issuance of misinformation as recently as last week about just this whole USADA situation, it's just this misinformation and a misunderstanding of what is contemplated here is a big problem. I couldn't agree more. The authority is going to work through committees, and they're going to work through staff. I think they're going to probably announce, I would like to think they're going to announce their new CEO shortly. We know they've been interviewing. And I think this is going to start to come together, and I think people will have a better understanding than in the vacuum that we're in right now. That's certainly be my hope. But the system will not work without the support provided by racing commissions, whether it's the safety program or whether it's the anti-doping program. And I think that's what you're going to see is going to happen. Let's take what the industry does well, and let's build on that, and let's attack those areas where we've been weak, where we failed, where there is concern, and fix them. But don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. That's not what was contemplated under HISA.
Sid, let me draw you back in as well. You're listening, and I introduced the first question to you, saying about the legalities, which you've, you know, you made it very clear early on that you felt that, you know, the HBPA challenge had tremendous merit, and if anything, the direction of the, you know, the court system was, you know, was headed more in that direction. So we'll see where that goes, and you know, I'll be at HBPA next month, and Eric Hamelbeck and team will undoubtedly, you know, we may have significant updates before February on the court case. But beyond that, talk to the perception, because I've listened to and saw you know, the Charlie Hayward piece, that Thoroughbred commentary, you know, this perception. I've had Alan on for years to essentially defend the concept that the, as Satish used to call it, the alphabet soup organizations were more effective, and that there was more good to what they were able to, you know, to handle than people make out. What, you know, what is workable in the existing frame that you see, and what area is the portion that could improve, you know, the way stakeholders, horse players, and the public look at the game? What is the most pressing area that needs to be addressed?
Well, I want to just, to your first part about this, you know, I've written about this through the years, from the very beginning, and first off, I appreciate everything Alan's done. And his sentiments about needing a change to the status quo. And I appreciate his viewpoint changing from the original plans, the Horse Racing Integrity Acts of years, to backing HISA. But historically, you know, I've written about this. And in particular, I wrote a piece in the TDN in 2019 that really did warn about certain possible areas of congressional overreach in these plans, the Horse Racing Integrity Act of 2017 in particular. And that column, I know, was circulated among people in Congress, and the new plans that came out addressed a lot of what I had talked about, of congressional overreach. In fact, some very specific areas were taken out because of that, and I talked to Eric Hamelbeck about that as well. I mean, he'd actually taken that column and given it to certain people. And so there has been some change to this plan to try to make it as palatable as possible. But to one of Chuck's points about getting this plan right before it came out. Now, there was a rush to get this done as quickly as possible because they wanted to get, you know, once, as Alan pointed out, with all these general news articles about 30 horses dying and Navarro and Service and all that, there was heightened atmosphere in racing. You had Dianne Feinstein doing her stuff, and you know, it was a critical point, so I understand that people did have to try to get McConnell on board and get this out as quickly as possible. But unfortunately, Steve, by rushing to do this and getting it out, they did leave themselves with some vulnerabilities. And you and I have talked about some of the state challenges based on the 10th Amendment anti-commandeering principles, congressional overreach, particularly after the 2018 Supreme Court decision on, you know, rescinding PASPA. This issue has really come out about, the anti-commandeering principle of the 10th Amendment, you know, which, you know, really prevents Congress from issuing direct orders to the states. That's why this plan, for example, has it as a voluntary state contribution instead of a mandate. And Alan's right. You need the state regulatory authorities to be on board for this thing to even go forward. However, it's written in a way that if the states don't support it, HISA would then go in, as he pointed out, and have to recreate some of this stuff. But even having said that, there's some flaws built into it. For example, HISA defines covered persons, those are any participants in this game, as people licensed by the state. So he pointed out, as I had, about FINRA. FINRA, the Financial Industries Regulatory Authority, which works with the SEC, as this HISA works with the FTC, FINRA is based on taxing or charging individuals or brokerage companies themselves, okay? Now, that's a very distinct difference from having a state involved in it. Whether it's voluntary or not, there's going to be state regulation involved if it's voluntary in the sense of state funding for this plan, but they're not going to be in control of the regulation because USADA or whatever entity is involved would be handling that. So there's a crossover into the states that's not there in FINRA. And, you know, it's really interesting how all these guys, Mark Summers, the attorney from the Jockey Club, he's written about it, but really playing it down and not exploring the issues which are pertinent here, and that the state, if this is going to be successful, have to really be involved. If the states are not involved in this, HISA is going to have to go out and recreate it and tax everybody, but they're doing it based on state licensees. So, I mean, it's the nuts and bolts of this, and which is really what you have to look at. I'm not against changing, obviously I believe we need to change something, but as somebody that has a very strong interest in constitutional law, and I'm not a lawyer, I mean, I can see myself, and I've written about it, and some of that stuff has been taken into account, but I can see all sorts of issues, Steve, that are going to even lead to more litigation and more court action down the road. And so what's the point of having something rushed out if it's going to potentially be rescinded as PASPA was? Suddenly all the energy was invested in something that potentially could be reversed in a court of law.
Well, and Alan, you...
Supreme Court decision on that.
Exactly. And Alan, and the way Chuck was also suggesting, the disappointment and the frustration under that scenario, I mean, based already on what, the frustration and hand-wringing over USADA, you know, not going forward as part of this, if that were to transpire, you basically were back to square one. So essentially, Alan, you've got the first 6 months of this year to either bring parties together or be in a position, should that happen, to have an alternate format. Is that practical? Is that even can that even be achieved?
Well, look, I am not, and I have no access to the inside of what the HISA board is doing, what planning they're doing, what staff is doing, or otherwise. What I do know is that they're on a very strict time schedule that for the adoption of regulations that was established by the Federal Trade Commission, because at the end of the day, the HISA board answers to the Federal Trade Commission, and the Trade Commission has issued that schedule, which is why you'll start to see proposed regulations being rolled out probably this week or next week, because there is a, under federal rules, there is a comment period for all interested parties to comment on proposed rules, for the authority board to reconsider proposed rules, make changes to proposed rules. But make no mistake, unless the courts somehow issue injunctive relief, meaning stop what you're doing, everybody hold in place until we hear more arguments about the constitutionality or the issues that have been raised. And there's two different lawsuits, by the way. HISA goes into effect on July 1, 2022. And the authority board has made clear that there are some aspects of the program that they intend to implement on the 1st of July and then January 1, 2023 for the balance. They have to appeal to the Federal Trade Commission for any extension of deadlines that have been established by the FTC. So we're all operating under the assumption that the program is going to go into effect on July 1. So there's a lot of work to be done. I agree, we have not seen any proposals with respect to funding. I have no inside information. I don't know what funding mechanisms they're looking at. One thing I would point out is that on July 1, anyone who is considered to be a covered person under the statute has to register with HISA. Okay, so whether you're licensed by a racing commission or not, if you are a covered person, meaning you're an owner, trainer, jockey, racetrack, breeder, veterinarian, you have to register with the authority. So unless the court...
Alan, was that put in the... That wasn't in the bill. Was that one of the
things that have been... It's in the bill. Look, I can pull it out, but...
yeah, that's fine. I take your word for it. Yeah.
It says it defines covered persons, and then it requires all covered persons to register with the authority. So the authority is going to have some kind of a database in place, and they're going to have a mechanism in place for people to register, because by registering, you become subject to the jurisdiction of the HISA authority. Okay, and that's separate from a racing commission license, because there are aspects of racing that are not within the jurisdiction of HISA that would still require you to hold a license. So they're going to have to, that's going to have to get sorted out.
Alan, can I ask you a question on that? How in the world could they possibly enforce that? And what happens if a person decides not to do that? And obviously an owner or a trainer, they could prevent them from racing, but specifically to the breeders, how in the world could you possibly enforce that? And what constitutes a breeder? A breeder that bred a horse last year or this year? How is that going to be enforced? It just doesn't seem possible.
First of all, there'll have to be guidance given, number one. Number two, the extent to which a breeder is covered, it was an issue, quite frankly, that I and a number of others raised and tried to get changed in the statute. A horse does not become a covered horse until it's either a two-year-old or it has a time workout, okay? At which point that horse has to be registered with the authority. So arguably breeders, unless they're engaging in some kind of a unfair and deceptive trade practice, probably aren't under the jurisdiction of HISA. So that's a very interesting question that you raise, and that is to what extent is a breeder required to register, and why is a breeder required to register? The funding formula provides that when a state determines how to pay for its share of the cost of HISA, it's to assess that cost among all covered persons. And that includes, as I recall the statute, breeders. So how do you tax the breeders, particularly one that's not licensed?
I mean, we have a hard time as trainers getting our owners who know they need licenses, who know when their horse is going to be run, to get them licensed in the proper time frame. So, the entire thing that made me skeptical about that is that, I mean, a lot of times you see these breeders, and they're not bred by, you know, Sid Fernando, even though they should be. They're bred by, you know, like the three blind mice, you know, LLC, or, and it's like, well, even in, you know, when it pertains to the ownership groups with, like some of the Baffert horses, and there's 10 people listed, not just you know, like a West Point where there's you know, Terry's usually listed, and then there's all the, you know, the partners underneath that, but like who takes you know, what if only 9 of them register and someone else doesn't register? And it just seems like, I mean, I know how the you can enforce it for trainers or anyone that's at the racetrack. You just, you know, deny them the ability to work or to enter. But like for the breeders, it always seemed like a pie in the sky thing that was going to be extremely costly to just to be chasing people around. I mean, like, do states even know who's breeding horses in their state? Because you know, you're not really required to register with the state unless it's, you know, through a state bred fund or something. I don't know.
Right.
It just seems nuts.
Right, only through the breeder organizations. But look, there are a lot of people who complain that if you're going to regulate the industry, you're going to regulate safety and welfare. Isn't it important to regulate the safety and welfare, breeding practices, sales practices? Why isn't that covered under the legislation? I mean, I argued that when I argued against the Horse Racing Integrity Act, that it didn't cover important aspects of our business that did implicate concerns about doping and safety and welfare. But it is what it is. With respect to these multiple ownership groups, most states have a requirement that you have to own a minimum of either 3% or 5% in order to be licensed. And I assume that Heisel will come out with some requirement, and they'll require a managing partner or managing director of one of these large entities to register all their members who own a minimum ownership, whatever that threshold is. But, yeah, I mean, look, there are going to be lots of issues, which is why it's going to be all the more important that they work with state racing commissions. And Ed Martin, who is head of the Racing Commissioners International, has reinforced that point ad nauseum. And at some point, if they haven't already begun to engage with him, they're going to have to.
And then there's Florida.
And then there's Florida. But that's part of the problem of why we have a Heisel, because you have a state that, you know, its regulatory structure is questionable at best.
Hey, and we were going to have a racing commission here, Alan, except it was involved in that compact that got struck down by the federal judge. So no one's even sure. I mean, they're acting, supposedly they're going forward with it, but it's, you know, like everything else, it seems like it's up in the air, and until we have details, no one really knows.
You know, look, I funding is everybody's concern. Don't think for a second it's not my concern, anybody else's concern. The unknown with respect to funding, it's the gorilla in the room. But, you know, I just look at the larger picture of what can get accomplished here. To, you know, as someone who's been involved in safety and welfare issues involving the horse now for the past decade, you know, and coming out of the fatalities at Aqueduct and the work that I did with Scott Palmer, Mary Scalay, Jerry Bailey. You know, I've been living that world, and I've been committed to that world. And it's always pained me that when the NTRA created this terrific Safety and Integrity Alliance, that tracks were unwilling to adopt even basic safety measures. That stakeholders, I mean, we were able to do it in the Mid-Atlantic, but it just pained me the number of states that were not willing to do it. When we adopted medication reforms that were designed to enhance our ability to identify horses at risk and implement safety measures to try to reduce fatalities, we had states unwilling to adopt those measures. And so that's, to me, the goal of uniformity. And then you get people who are really upset right now with just, without taking sides on Bob Baffert or any of these other issues, just the way our process works. In today's world, people just don't understand it in the current context. That may have worked 20, 30 years ago. It just doesn't work today, and we don't have a good answer for it. This would help to solve that problem. Our horsemen complain about testing. They go from state to state. They want to know why it's a positive one state, not in another. There are lots of complaints about that. This is an opportunity to, you know, be able to address that and better focus our attention on it. And
let me ask you this question. I don't mean to interrupt, but I really wanted to ask you this pointed question, and it's about, you know, because you brought up Bob Baffert. There are other bad actors in the business, not named Bob Baffert, that a lot of us just kind of don't understand why they continue to be licensed by the state despite having 50, 60, 70 medication violations. And is there a provision or some way to make it where those kind of people, I mean, if I had 70 violations in the last 5 years and I went to get a driver's license, well, you know, that's not going to happen. So how come a person can be given a professional license to operate in a parimutuel sport when they have just an egregious record of not following the rules? And, you know, is there any way that we can make it more difficult for people that have a lot of issues to be licensed? Because, again, these people are creating the lion's share of the problems.
If you're talking about medication violations, we've got the answer in the Mid-Atlantic and those other states that were willing to adopt it. That's the multiple medication violation program that's in the HISA statute and is required. There's a perfect example of states that just weren't willing to do it. It's a program that started in the Mid-Atlantic, became a national program. Look how long it took to get it done in California. Look how long it's taking to get it done in Kentucky. Look at states that don't want to do it. We're doing it in the Mid-Atlantic, and we rarely see a repeat offender. We started the program 4 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago in the Mid-Atlantic. We don't have repeat offenders here anymore. And if so, they're identified, and they have mandatory penalties. So there is a system that works. With HISA oversight, I think they will start to identify individuals with numerous violations and whether or not they should be licensed or not. I put that all in context, but it'll be a much more transparent system. So there's ways to address it. It's just HISA just point. It's textbook as to one of the good aspects of HISA is uniformity. It will require everyone to do it and to follow the same protocols, and that to me is a positive.
I think that's really, like, there's a couple key things that most horsemen are concerned about. That is one of them, is how are these guys allowed to continue to operate? Obviously, like you touched on before, everybody wants clear, concise, allowable medication rules that we feel safe, treating our horses properly, but not having to wonder if we're going to get a positive here or if this lab tests differently, blah, blah, blah. We've talked about that for years. But, the other thing that I was hoping that HISA would institute in some way, shape, or form, and maybe not in the beginning, but as we get along, that there really needs to be, and we had talked about the investigative force. I mean, to me, the bringing back the TRPB would make the most sense, but there needs to be a training program for racetrack security, because let me just tell you this, and I've been all over the country. There is no deterrent at any track outside of Derby Week or the Breeders' Cup. There just isn't. And for the most part, you have people that are making minimum wage or just above minimum wage. They're not trained. They really don't know what to even look for. And it's just one of the reasons why guys are operating freely is because there literally is no deterrent. And that's something that really, to me, would be a huge step in the right direction. Because in the end, testing is still a needle in a haystack kind of thing. Catching a guy with a syringe in his hand in a stall is not.
I, I would agree. I think we've heard that from, I hear that from everyone, the failure of track security. I still think the lack of a, when I started in the business, there was a TRPP agent at every track. And when I started, I was in the Attorney General's office in Maryland, and I met with the TRPB investigator in Maryland once a week, where he would go over files with me, individuals who were identified, conduct being identified. It was one of the more interesting aspects of the work I did in racing at the time. But we don't have that anymore. And I think everybody would agree with that, and I think that's something that HISA will ultimately look at.
We talked about that, Alan, and in fact, I'm going to try to bring Paul Berube in, who, you know, the last, most apparent leader at TRPB that when it came to, you know, on-track investigation, and you told me about Cliff Wickham, who preceded him, but that, you know, that's got to be the, you know, the biggest opportunity. We've also over the years talked about things like, you know, one division of stakeholder that hasn't come up here in you know, an hour of discussion is the veterinarians. The conversation about having commissaries, dispensaries essentially on track, that nobody can bring anything on track that you know isn't there. And I know that there are some drawbacks about emergencies and so forth. However, that's a topic that could be expanded, and that, you know, if you don't let anything on the backstretch, that is illegal, or could be used illegally, then you've inhibited the possibility.
Steve, the problem with that is without security, it doesn't mean anything.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I mean,
make you know appointments at the bank when they're going to rob them.
If everybody is subject to search and seizure coming through the gate, right? I mean, Alan, you talked about this when there was that handful of trainers that were barred by Gulfstream. The granting of license is a privilege that can be revoked at any time. So, I mean, this is all, you know, it's got to be comprehensive. And I mean, are you confident that the tracks buy in on all this as well?
Well, I can't tell you that the tracks buy in or don't buy in, but it is certainly something that is very much front and center in discussions that I have with horsemen's groups. In forums that I'm in, is this whole issue of track security, horses coming in and out, are they identified? With the new chip system, it should be a lot easier to do it. That's a whole fertile ground that needs to be dealt with. I think we're all in agreement on that. You know, with respect to TRPB, I don't know if it was Chuck or Sid who was talking about wagering security as something just as important. If there's something that TRPB does presently and does it well, it's wagering security. They've got a guy named Curtis Linnell,
sure,
who was head of the TRPB. I mean, he's an expert. He is a gem for the industry. And you could take that opposite and expand it into the other aspects of track security and investigations and the like. Steve, you ought to have Paul Berube. You want to just listen to the guy. He's one of the really superstars from a prior era before he retired. He's the guy who broke the Valentine's Day race-fixing scandal in Maryland back in 1974. Single-handedly did it. The guy's got a photographic memory, and he's a brilliant investigator.
Well, we're going to get, I've been wanting to get Paul on for a while, and I had the young trainer that he's got a couple of horses for Paul that We're going to get him on. We're coming up toward the top of the hour. Sid, quick final, some final thoughts. We'll obviously talk tomorrow with Sire Watch Pedigree Focus, brought to you by Hill and Dale. But some final
thoughts from you. It's been a great conversation. I've really enjoyed listening to you guys. My real fear about all this, Steve, is what I've reiterated before, that in my opinion, it looks like there are some challenges to this law that could end up becoming a thorn in its side down the road to the effect of even repealing it. So, that's just the the bad feeling I have about this is I just think that everything we're talking about and others have talked about, I wish we had the time before this bill was pushed through to have addressed some of these issues, because everything we've just talked about today, I mean, really important stuff, some of the stuff not really addressed in this bill. And that's always the danger for the sport, that we try to change something for the better, the betterment of the game, that is. And ultimately, if it gets pulled out, it's a wasted opportunity.
Well, we're obviously going to have to be prepared, as it came up, to move in a different direction if, in fact, the legal challenge comes to pass, too. So there's reasons to be hopeful, I would say. It's the beginning of the year, so let's be hopeful. And there's reasons to be concerned. As always, people like Sid and Chuck and Alan have devoted their lives to this industry and want the best for it. So, Sid, thank you. We'll talk tomorrow. Alan, as always, greatly appreciated. And Chuck,
thank you.
Great to have you back in the studio. And we will we'll talk to you soon, too. Thank you, guys.
Cheers, Sid.
Thanks, guys.
Cheers. Thank you.
Sid, Alan, and Chuck. Nice trio to bat around this topic. A lot of shoes yet to drop. It's like Imelda Marcos's closet. Thanks to the guys for the visit and to the beginning of the morning, to Dash Goff. You'll see the Arkansas Derby win picture in a couple of minutes when I put up today's listing. Andy Serling as well. Back tomorrow. Sid, Sire Watch Pedigree Focus, brought to you by Hill and Dale, and we'll check in with Seth Merrill, and we'll also get started to the Sam Houston Race Park season and more. Good luck if you're playing today, everybody. Talk to you in the morning.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
There's a great story to tell in Pennsylvania. Only 3 states have produced more Breeders' Cup champions, and no state can match our performance in recent years. Since 2016, our numbers of mares bred has skyrocketed, unlike the national trend. And this year's live foal report shows Pennsylvania up over 50%. Why? Our incentives and bonuses are the best in North America. Please visit us at pabred.com and see why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development before we ever put out a product. Because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us. Because what we say is in them is in them. Because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Bleeder Shield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.
Horsebills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving, paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through Horsebills.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay only our low monthly subscription fee. Check out our video tutorial on the Horsebills.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. Horsebills.com. Toll-free number 888-938-4643.